Hey, you are about to listen to episode one of the JV Club. It's not the first episode I recorded, but it is the first one to be released. I just want to take a second to thank everybody at Nerdist for generally just being super awesome, as well as all of the amazing guests that I've had so far, whose episodes I'm so excited to share with you. The JV Club's loose structure involves talking about our teenage years and how much or how little we've changed. I hope you like it.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hey, this is the JV Club. I'm Janet Varney. My guest for this podcast is just kind of a wonderful, amazing woman who is a wonderful, wonderful actor and has worked for quite some time. And you may know her for a lot of different reasons from a lot of different things. Many people know her from her role on Mad Men. Her name is Christina Hendricks.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for doing the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's always fun, the first couple of awkward moments of, oh my gosh, we're sitting in my home, which is very homey, but then we also are talking into microphones as if we're doing a press conference, and we're staring straight at each other across the table.
And it feels like no one else is really listening to us.
And eventually someone will, but we're not live, so eventually someone will. But if anything comes up and you suddenly realize, like, you know what, I wish I wouldn't have said that. We can also edit it out.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you just have some sort of explosion of curse words because you just need to get that out of your system, we can decide.
It's Monday.
You and I can decide later if we even want to include all of that stuff.
Okay.
What'd you have for breakfast? I don't know if that doesn't.
Oh.
I've never asked that before.
That's a good starter, and I have a really good answer.
You do?
Yeah.
What'd you have?
I went to my girlfriend's graduation party last night, and her whole family's Armenian, and they made incredible food, and I just raided it all and took it all home.
Yeah.
And my husband and I had leftover Armenian food this morning.
So what was it? What was it?
Stuffed grape leaves. Yum. And red pepper and feta dip and vegetables and this really beautiful smoked meat with all these gorgeous spices. It was fantastic.
Oh, my gosh. That sounds really good. I asked you that question because I'm hungry and I just realized I love thinking about food. I just opened a Real Simple that had a Nora Ephron quote that said like something like, I don't know, life wouldn't be worth living unless I'm always thinking about what I'm going to eat next. And it just made me laugh because
we plan entire vacations around food.
I mean, food is so good.
I know.
Food's good, right, you guys? Again, thanks for listening to the podcast. That's it.
Also, interesting fact is the last time we saw each other, we were playing other people.
That's true.
So we were especially not revealing information about ourselves.
That's very true. We were at our friend's birthday party and we did like a fun, weird, stupid murder mystery thing where we were all playing different characters.
Yeah.
And you were a beautiful Southern debutante.
Yeah,
and
I was kind of mean, though.
But you were mean. We all had a streak of evil because we all had to be capable of murder. Please.
Exactly.
And
you were
I was a
French-Canadian. French girl with a French-Canadian.
Oh, yeah. I tried to make her more twangy and brassy than French.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. I'm a little bit obsessed with Celine Dion's accent because it's so specific and her cadence is so specific. And I both hate and love it that I find every opportunity to impersonate her without actually saying that I'm impersonating her.
I can't keep my eyes off her when she's on my TV screen.
I agree.
I just feel like something crazy is about to happen.
I couldn't agree more. I wouldn't call myself a fan, but that doesn't mean I don't think she has it, whatever it is.
I agree.
She's got it. More than maybe anyone I've ever seen
in my
entire
really
life.
Got it.
She's got it. I almost made it sound like it was a sickness. Oof, she's got it. You're totally right. She's captivating.
She is captivating. Remember that white backwards suit she once wore?
Yes.
With like a very tall...
Yes.
She was like an Alice in Wonderland character.
It was
like
ridiculous.
A chess piece.
It was ridiculous, but it wasn't... I don't know why there's a difference between her and Lady Gaga, but for some reason, there's something different about...
Well,
like,
yeah. I mean, Lady Gaga arrives in an egg.
Yeah.
So you're expecting...
Right.
Something quite
right.
grand.
And Celine isn't always... Yeah, you know she'll... that's it. She hasn't made a thing of trotting out crazy stuff. So when she does,
yeah,
you're like, oh, okay. This is another thing I have to process as I'm processing the it that you have that I can't take my eyes
exactly.
off of.
Now I got to process your suit.
Yeah. And also the unapologetic presentational way she performs, like that's old school. Mm-hmm. I don't have that. I don't know that I could ever be that over the top, passionate about every note I was singing if my life depended on it. Could you?
I think I could do it. If I had an entire Vegas theater, I think I could do it.
You'd probably grow and stretch into that personality yeah. as befits, right? You yeah. would just sort of, oh my gosh. Okay, so you were from Idaho.
That's
Celine
mean.
Dion is not from Idaho. No, I'm from Arizona, and I've spent a lot of time in Idaho. I have my family, my mom's sister and her whole family live in Idaho Falls.
Oh.
And my dad's girlfriend has a cabin in Driggs, Idaho.
Shut up.
I won't. This is a podcast.
No,
you know what?
You don't understand how many years of my life I've spent in Driggs.
Really?
No one lives in Driggs. It's like population 200.
Yeah,
or something.
It's tiny. Well, listen.
Where is it?
Her cabin is up a little further out from Driggs.
That's amazing.
Isn't that crazy?
Driggs and Victor.
I love it.
Did you eat at the Knotty Pine?
We ate at the Knotty Pine.
No one knows the Knotty Pine.
So you spent a ton of time in Driggs, but were you born there or were
no,
you where
I
you from
actually,
in Idaho?
I was born in Tennessee, but I lived in Idaho starting in the middle of third grade, and I lived in Twin Falls.
Okay.
And I lived there until the end of junior high, and then I moved to Virginia.
Okay.
But I would say I always sort of consider Idaho my home. I think it was where I was happiest, mm-hmm. and I still have friends there, and I like to go back and visit.
Virginia for how long before you moved?
Virginia just for high school, and then I moved to New York.
Was it hard to move?
Yes.
End of junior high, beginning. Did you begin high school in Virginia?
Yeah. And was really, really happy in Idaho.
Yeah.
And that's where I started doing community theater for the first time and had this amazing group of kids that were really talented. And
yeah.
We were in Jump Company, which was the junior musical playhouse.
Oh, that's adorable.
And you know, we put on pretty good productions.
Yeah.
I mean, they were really quite good and everyone was really talented. And a lot of those kids have gone on and are still in the arts. And so when my dad wanted to move, it was being yanked out of that sort of perfect scenario, you know, all these talented kids and you're discovering something that you're excited about and you're in this beautiful town where there's a lot of great family values and then you're snatched
up. What took you guys to Virginia? What did your dad do?
My dad worked for the Forest Service mm-hmm. and he didn't necessarily have to move. He just would be like, it's time to move. And
Papa's a Rolling Stone. How annoying that I would say that. Forgive me.
So then
he liked moving around.
And so we got to Virginia, and you know, most people don't think Virginia big city, but for me, it was like moving to Fairfax, Virginia was the big city. And I went to school the first day in my Birkenstocks and my like weird tunic outfit that I had
yes,
on.
I love it.
Which was very avant-garde in Idaho, by the way.
But you were in Jump. You were in Jump.
I was in
theater
Jump.
Company, so you could do whatever you wanted. I mean, people knew you were an artsy type, but you had talent.
Yeah, but yeah, it was supported in Idaho. You know, we only had two high schools in our town, and When we did a production with Jump Company, the entire town came out to see
that.
It at the college. It was really supportive.
Yeah.
And it was cool.
Yeah.
To be in Jump Company.
Yeah.
Then
yeah.
I moved to Virginia and wah, wah.
Tunic
being
and Birkenstocks.
In the theater groups, not so hip anymore.
Isn't it funny how that, I mean, that really does, I feel like that's true of my various friends that I didn't know in high school that I know in the business now. And then I have other friends who were like, you know, you were in theater, so you were a total reject. But
yeah, we couldn't even eat in the lunchroom.
Is that true? So you really went from like, you knew that was what you wanted to do and what you wanted to be doing, and you went from where it meant a lot to where it was like, ugh, theater.
It was so strange because it was something that was making me so happy.
Yeah.
And it was so supported and it was so fun. And I was a dancer and I was learning how to sing and, you know, it was just fantastic. And then I get to Virginia to this high school and literally we're like shunned. And I just didn't even understand. It was just
So was it sports experience. And stuff that was that were popular?
Yeah, you know, that's
pep
that's
rallies what, and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah.
So and okay, I know you became goth, so I want to get to that. But let me ask you really quickly to put it in context: who's we? When you say we, is it your mom, dad, you, and do you have siblings?
I have one older brother.
And we joke that Christina, the only thing she wouldn't talk about was whether she had siblings or not. That's why we started laughing.
No, I have an older brother, and he's fabulous, and he lives in Los Angeles now too. But we both did the theater together, and he actually finished high school before we moved to Virginia.
Oh, okay.
So he actually got that great experience, and he started directing plays in high school, and he was really, really great at it.
Yeah.
So he luckily got to sort of be celebrated in that way.
Did he move with you guys even though he was done with school, and did he go to college out there?
Yeah, he went to college in Virginia and continued to study theater and all of that. So he went, you know, to a school that also celebrated it. You know, he went to his college. So I was just very surprised and confused and didn't understand why everyone wasn't really down with the theater.
Yeah. Okay. So you start school and you've got your tunic, and your Birkenstocks on, and you report to theater. Were the kids in the theater department? Did you still connect with them? Like, did you have a good kind of friendship with those guys? Or were some of those kids also, were you like, oh, you're not?
It was a mixed bag.
Yeah.
It was a mixed bag of people. I think that the theater department always is.
You know,
you've got all sorts.
Yeah, we have like stoners who just didn't want to do anything to like the kids.
The real
who
Renaissance fair kind of group.
Yeah. To like a couple of guys, like in my high school, nobody was really out. Like, I don't think of it as a restrictive time, and I don't think of, you know, the 80s and 90s as like, oh, you couldn't be gay in high school. But when I think about my friends who came out, they all came out after high school, and they were like hiding in theater, not out for me. So I had that too. I had some of those guys and girls.
Cause it was like three quarters of the guys that I was friends with were gay, and they were actually out.
That's cool.
There was no hiding. Some of that.
Had no choice. Yeah.
And I was the girl who would like go to prom with the gay friend, you know. So I went to lots of proms as the
That's kind of adorable.
As the beard date.
And so A, lucky them. B, so you still had some relationship. So you guys were I have so many questions. You guys were shunned and you didn't even go to the lunchroom.
We didn't go to the lunchroom. We had a little nook that we sat in outside the auditorium where our theater was. And we had a very cool theater teacher who would write excuses for us to not go to the assemblies.
Oh, that's awesome.
I know. He kind of understood how traumatic it was to go to these things.
Yeah.
And he would just let us like study in the theater if we wanted to while other people were at assemblies.
That's cool that you guys still had that kind of theater community, even if you were mildly ostracized for it in high school. Because I felt like I knew that theater was like hugely important to me also in high school, but my theater teacher was like kind of just not present. I mean, we would do plays, but if we weren't working on a play, it really was like a free period. We spent so much time in the dressing rooms, like with the lights off, telling stories and making out and stuff and like sneaking cigarettes and whatnot. And I just think to myself, at the time that was like what was normal, but there's no way our parents knew that we were in the theater class for six period, really doing absolutely nothing.
We definitely had periods of that as well. And my teacher was particularly interested in the technical side of things. So he was really interested in getting money to like get the most expensive stage equipment.
Uh-huh.
like I don't know why we needed these things.
Yeah.
And he was really into stage combat.
Okay.
So we would learn how to do
that
like rolls and things that just
that
have,
makes sense.
Yeah. You know, I've never used one of those, by the way.
That's really funny.
But you know, he was trying and he was good. And the funny thing about him too is that we would put on these plays that were really adult.
Yeah.
Like All My Sons or something. Like these very dramatic. We did Agnes of God.
Okay.
Like,
All right.
I mean, it's not your normal high school.
Did you Shakespeare stuff too? Or were you mostly doing contemporary?
No.
Interesting.
Yeah. But these are the plays he chose. And it was wild. Agnes. But I, God. Yeah, I was Agnes.
I bet you
little
were.
Little stigmata there in high school.
I bet you were.
Little rigged up system I had so the blood could come out.
Of course, the most expensive fake suicide equipment money could buy.
I had like one of those IV bags like taped under my nun's habit that I would then hit.
Hilarious. And then I'm sure as your teacher's like, I'm not concerned about the performance, but if that blood doesn't come out when it's supposed to, then the budget I've got is not going to be well paid.
I remember being really, really into that performance, and it was like very, very important to me. And in fact, when I moved to Los Angeles, my brother was working next door to a talent manager, managed actors, and my brother said, "You really should meet with my sister. She's really talented." And he was like, "Yeah, yeah, everyone's got a talented sister in this town." He's like, "No, I saw her in Agnes of God. It was amazing."
The worst thing he could have said.
So in a way, Agnes of God got me my first manager because he agreed to take a meeting with me. Hey. And he was my first manager.
Oh, that's so funny. Oh, my gosh, that's really funny. I thought I was going to be like, "Yeah, Agnes of God. Now I'm really never going to, like, I know what that means."
It was a testament to my brother's personality that he did that for him, you know,
and that you came and delivered and ended up signing with that manager.
I razzle dazzled him.
You did well. You probably did a monologue from Agnes of God.
I didn't. I had a meeting and I had like, you know, a modeling portfolio, and I think I'd done some commercials, and I showed him the commercials I had.
And this was coming from New York to LA.
New York, I had lived in London for a year, and then I moved to LA.
So in terms of like dating and stuff, did you kind of stay within the theater department, or were you dating boys from different schools? Like, how did that go?
I really just dated one boy, I met him at Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Love everything about that. Love everything about that. Who was he dressed as, if anyone?
He was not dressed as a character, but he had a long purple mohawk and his Doc Martens. And
okay, you know. So we have entered goth phase for sure.
Yes,
punk
we were
rock.
Full on into goth
when you
phase
were in Idaho point. I know you to have worn Birkenstocks and a tunic.
Yes, but see, accurate? I did. To me, Birkenstocks were not a hippie thing in any way. We would wear, we had our own.
I kind of did too. Like, I didn't consider myself a hippie, but I would wear like long gypsy skirts, but then I would have like a, like the Police t-shirt or something, like
totally.
Peter Gabriel or like
we had so few resources to shop at.
Okay.
I would make a lot of clothes with my mom. Like, I would be like, "Hey, I like those sort of," it was before MC Hammer, but I thought they were like these really cool sort of ethnic looking pants with the low baggy crotch.
Oh,
you know?
Sure. Like pajama pants, kind of like harem pants,
I
guess.
I made them out of like snakeskin material.
Hey, don't mind if I do, Idaho.
Yeah.
Love
and just
it.
Like weird, you know, things that I'd find at the Salvation Army, and then my Birkenstocks and a weird headband, and it was sort of like a...
But that goes back to like I feel like, I mean, I'm from Tucson, Arizona, and it's, again, it's not like a hugely metropolitan city, and I feel like there is, for me, I remember a certain level of Anything Goes that I really embraced, because I didn't have that much money, and I definitely had girlfriends who were, I mean, I for sure wanted a pair of Guess jeans. Like, there's no question that that befell me. Like, oh, I want swatches. I want, you know, two layers
swatches.
Of socks when I was in junior high and all that kind of stuff. But I'm glad that
socks.
It wasn't fluorescent for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm glad that that was not, I'm glad I kind of didn't have the access to that monetarily, and that there were so many kids who didn't there, and that it wasn't like living in Los Angeles or Beverly Hills or something when I was that age, because there was a lot of like, well, I'm going to raid my mom. Like, my mom kept a bunch of her clothes from the 60s, you know, in a trunk, and at some point she let me start wearing them, and so I would be wearing like a weird peasant blouse. But again, to your point, not because I thought of myself as a hippie, just because I was like, this is weird.
Yeah, exactly.
What would happen if I put a bowler hat on top of this? Fantastic.
I was far more creative in Idaho. You know, and this is, I wasn't, you know, we didn't have the internet. We weren't watching.
Yeah.
I'm like, I sound like I'm like,
I know.
I grew up in Victorian ages.
I know. I felt like that. I feel like that sometimes.
I wasn't watching MTV. Like, we didn't pay for cable channels and stuff. So all these references were like from other people you knew in town, or because I was a dancer, a lot of it was about a sort of dancer look.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it was about what was on sale at the mall.
Yeah.
It was what I could order out of a catalog and get into, you know, Twin Falls. And it was this hodgepodge. And my mom, I would put these outfits together. My mom would be like, "You look beautiful.
Oh,
you look magnificent. magnificent. She just was so supportive. And
she
just
was. Yeah.
Thought I looked amazing every time I put together some concoction. And
yeah.
So really, you know, when I moved to Virginia, and then it became the sort of classic mod girl and the classic goth girl. It was just sort of reflections of everything I was seeing around me.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was far cooler before. I knew what I thought was cool.
Yeah. I guess even when I was in high school and kind of doing the goth thing, it was still weirdly stitched together from, like, you know, Fourth Avenue was like the area. Like, I guess, I don't know. I mean, it's not really like Melrose here, because Melrose is absolutely not that. But yeah. In terms of like, so like if you stripped away all the bullshit on Melrose and you, all the stuff that you hate and you would never want, like the hookah stores and stuff.
Yeah.
You're like, that's maybe one too many hookah stores, guys. And then just
no
have
one
like
owns
the,
a hookah yeah, anyway.
Yeah. Like, but like the Goodwills and then the vintage stores that are like a step up from that. That's sort of like, oh, we specialize in you know, the '50s. And then, oh, this is the only, no, you come here if you want a Halloween costume, but just once in a while, you might find something you can use in the everyday. And, you know, there's that little tiny little stretch in Tucson that I had. But to get back to your family environment, it sounds to me like even though you moved, you had the benefit of your parents were together,
mm-hmm.
and that you, it sounds like they were super supportive, and you had a good relationship, a close relationship with your brother, where you guys were in doing theater together.
Yeah, we shared a sort of friend group, which was nice. It was nice for me. It was probably, you know, get my little sister away from me a little bit for him. But
right.
But I thought it was cool, and I think I've always, because of that, had friends of all ages too, much younger than me and much older than me. I think when you get involved in theater, age sort of disappears and everyone becomes friends.
Yeah, and that kind of that carries over here too. Mm-hmm. I meet people and I'm just getting to the point now where I have a couple of friends that I became close to without having any sense of how old they were, and after like the first couple of times we hung out, they told me how old they are, and I was like, I'm 10 years older than you. I thought we were the same age. I mean, I really thought we were the exact same age.
Yeah, I can't guess age anymore.
Yeah,
and
I can't either.
For years, I would see like a goth kid walk by on the street, and I'd give them the old,
me too.
Hey, we're in the same club look. And they'd look at me like, don't look at me, old lady.
Oh, for sure.
And I'm like, oh my gosh, he thinks I'm like judging him, and I'm trying to give him the, we're totally in the same school.
I totally know. I think there's something, I don't know if that's true. I mean, I don't know if that's true. I've never really talked about this with someone who wasn't, but in fact, I don't really talk about this. But now that you're saying this, it just makes me wonder, is there something about having gone through that phase, that specific phase where you're like, whether you're thinking about it overtly or not, that if you're in this space of like, hey, everyone, look at me, I'm bad, or like, I'm, you know,
I'm not
reckless,
like you.
Or I might shoplift, or I might, like, even if you are or are not doing drugs, or are not stealing, or are not, you know, just generally wreaking havoc.
I'm dangerously different.
You could, you're dangerously different. There's an edge. There's like a fuck you to it. And this idea that you never, like, you hold on to that in a way that maybe you don't. I mean, maybe somebody who is like a huge jock who is playing football feels like when they see a football player, they're like, hey, buddy, you and me. And maybe the football player's thinking, like, get out of here, old man. But for me and you, what I relate to is that same idea, to the point where I still feel like sometimes when I'm riding my bike in my own neighborhood, like if it's dusk, I'm riding my bike and I have this apologetic feeling like people are probably like, what are you doing here? Like, what kind of trouble are you going to stir up? Are you going to steal
something?
First of all,
Janet is blonde hair, blue eyes.
I mean,
sweet as
but
can
it's
be
all,
looking.
You know what I mean? Like, it's some, there's something.
But you feel threatening.
Once you've been looked at that way.
Right.
But I hold on to that on purpose too,
right.
I think. And when I see somebody, I was just riding my bike home. I rode my bike to my friend's birthday party. And so I rode, and like, knowing full well that I would regret it, because I knew I was going to come home at like midnight on my bike, which is not safe. But I do have a very bright headlamp, guys. and I was riding up through Ferndale, up into Griffith Park to get home. And there were a bunch of goth kids, like somebody had a mohawk and, you know, everybody was wearing black. I was like, oh, I've traveled through time. It's somewhere in time, goth version. And I was riding past and I felt like I in my mind, I was sharing a moment with them. Like, I'm riding through the park. It's midnight. You guys are smoking some joints. what's up, guys? And then I realized, like, seriously, I'm on my bike with my helmet, my bike gloves, my headlamp that's, like, as bright as a car headlight.
Perfectly
I'm sure they were like, who's that soccer mom for some reason riding her bike this late? Like, what happened to her? Off to play a tennis game or whatever. But in my mind, I could have got off my bike and been like, what's up, you guys?
I know. Every once in a while, I've had people be like, I bet you were a cheerleader in high school.
Yeah, and I'm like, how dare
why
you?
Why would you ever
That's
say
what I
that?
Say. That's what I say. I never.
Yeah.
I never wanted that. I mean, I'm not to say that there's anything wrong with that. I have friends who were the homecoming
me
queen.
Me too, but I just wonder
but
why
I could
someone
never,
would look at me and think
I
that.
I know. I could never.
Positive energy.
But it's funny because I never would have thought that about you. Like, I was not in the least surprised. I was delighted when you said you had been a goth, but I was not surprised.
Right. That's why I'm surprised when someone says that. I feel like goth is written all over me still. Isn't
yeah.
that funny? It's
yeah.
just, you can't shake it off of you.
But apparently that's not true. Well, I had a tattoo for a really long time that's like two solid black bands right here.
It's totally
that I had
gone.
To get. Yeah, I had to. I mean, I got it removed. I suppose I didn't have to get it removed, but I did get it removed because when I lived in San Francisco, I mean, I had like short boyish hair and my hair was usually bright red. And, you know, I definitely still had like some, I don't know, whatever that alternative San Francisco thing is. And so I had this tattoo and nobody was surprised by it. And also lots of people in San Francisco have tattoos who don't necessarily look like they would. And then I moved down here and when I started working, it was my first – and that was in my mid-20s, my late 20s. So I really didn't – I hadn't been exposed since high school to that, like, where do you fit – in the same, like clicks or like your type.
Too. It's so funny too when you feel a certain way inside and you know yourself, and then you walk into a room to audition for something, and they're telling you what they see, and it's
yeah.
so different.
Yeah.
And I had to sort of make peace with that when I first started auditioning for shows. I auditioned for some sitcoms, and I've always considered myself sort of the quirky, funny girl.
Yeah, me
and
too.
I killed this audition. I felt great about it. They called and they
I'm
said,
sure
we
you were
love
too
her.
Pretty.
They said, well, she's too sexy to play this yeah. quirky role. And I said, well, why yeah. can't you be quirky and sexy? That doesn't make
I'm
any
sorry,
sense to me.
I'm sorry, you can't, Christina.
I know. Well, I didn't get the job.
I mean, but
they
it's true.
Really
it's,
felt strongly about that.
It's really true. There, I think, and that's what, and that's actually what one of the things that made me want to start this podcast was like, I think, you know, if I were – when I was 16, I knew I wanted to be an actor. And even if I hadn't – I mean, all my friends who were into totally other stuff, like girlfriends of mine who wanted to be veterinarians, were still fascinated by Hollywood or fascinated by, you know, celebrity. Unfortunately, that – sometimes fortunately, sometimes unfortunately, that's such a big part of our American culture. And I guess I thought – wow, now that I'm dropped back into this place where suddenly all that stuff matters and I have to kind of be mindful about how I let that affect my sense of self and my identity and really relating back to those times of like, oh God, it mattered so much or, you know, I didn't know, like, why can't I just be that Idaho kid again,
yeah.
like wearing this ridiculous thing? And we were even talking about before we started recording, we were joking outside about the purple hat ladies or like getting like these old kooky people we see at vintage fairs who, you know, you sort of at first pass or depending on what mood I am, I look at them and I'm like, oh no, like, oh, you're embarrassing me. I'm embarrassed for you. To another day where I'll be like, you go and you wear whatever you want. And we should all feel that way. We should all
yeah.
feel beautiful. We should all feel like we can wear whatever we want. And that's what I would have wanted to hear. Like if I could have heard, and believe me, I'm not saying I'm this person, but you are. If I could have heard, you know, Madeline Kahn or Terry Garr or anybody that I looked up to or thought was beautiful or sexy or on a show I loved watching when I was a teenager, it would have really helped me to hear that person say, oh, by the way, I totally, you know, still face yada, yada, yada. Or
yeah.
this person thought I was this just based on how I looked. Or this, what you're just saying. I mean, it's so fascinating. I that idea of like, I'm sorry, but you can't be both.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's too bad because, like you said, you go to a vintage expo or you see these women who are dressed very flamboyantly or something. And I really, you know, you try to make sure that Hollywood isn't influencing that when you look at those people, they look fabulous because they feel fabulous.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate that now when you see actresses on the red carpet and going to these premieres and events, that it's so specific about what you should wear and how people are going to ridicule you. And you can't wear prints because that's just too crazy to wear a floral print. Yeah. And you can't wear stripes because that's just nuts.
Yeah.
And it has to show enough skin, but it can't be too much because then you'll be ridiculed for that. And you really can show very little of your personality.
Yeah.
And you, it's this balance of feeling beautiful and feeling like yourself and hoping that no one's just downright mean to you.
Well, that's, yeah. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, you don't, that stuff evolves faster than maybe you can keep up with in terms of like people say, you know, I'm sorry, but they're in the movies. They're asking for it. Like that's the price you pay.
That is so bizarre to me.
Put yourself in the position where haven't you ever, no matter what you're doing in your life and whether you're in school or whether you're like, you do something that makes sense for you and the way that other people take it or the way it gets reflected back to you hurts your feelings. And you're not necessarily thinking about that because you can't think about that all the time. You can't constantly be thinking, how is this choice going to potentially smack me back when it's an innocent choice and it's small, like what I'm wearing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think, I mean, if everybody who wanted to be an actor said, well, you know what, I'm just not going to audition for that because there's a chance someday this choice might lead someone to say, I'm an asshole who's never met me before, and then everyone will start to think that. No one would work. There wouldn't be television. You wouldn't be able to turn on the television and see people who have talent who are engaging doing stuff. But why couldn't you just wear what, you know? I mean, I don't know.
It's very strange. And I think our culture has gotten so involved in criticism and looking for flaws in people.
Yeah.
And now with Twitter and with Facebook and, you know, a lot of these comments that are out there people are not being nice to one another anymore.
I know.
Whether it's a complete stranger or to one another.
Yeah.
And I know that these tools were great ideas, but I just feel like they've turned into this machine of people not having privacy anymore and people being able, it's like the worst gossip that can spread in 2 seconds about someone.
I know.
And sometimes you think you're just tweeting something and out into the universe and you don't realize that those people hear those things and it hurts your feelings really badly.
Yes. Yes.
Like I have had moments at home, like crying on my couch because, you know, who knows? Who knows if it's a 12-year-old in their basement or a producer down the road? But they're writing horribly mean things about you. And you're like, what did I do? I didn't do anything. I just went to a party in a dress.
I know. It's so silly. You know? And I think, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think what I would like and what you hope is that, I mean, it's such a double-edged sword. Or I don't know. I guess there's two sides to every coin. It's not a double-edged sword because the good part's good. And I don't mean that a sword, I think, will kill you no matter which side you use. But what I like about even just doing this podcast or what I like about Twitter, what I like about the immediacy of, you know, oh, you can follow Neil Patrick Harris and you can see the moment, you know, seconds after he said, I love my children so much and I just had to tell everyone that, to know that that literally just happened and he's literally the person that just immediately communicated to everyone is so appealing. I totally get the appeal of that. And I think the opportunity for it to be used for good is, it's so personal now and it's so familiar and everything you're saying, it's so immediate. If anything, you would hope, and what I want and what I hope is sort of maybe the backlash to all of the negativity is it should remind all of us more how human we all are and that we are all people with feelings and that you're not a person that doesn't feel bad if someone says something shitty just because you're on a show and they've seen you in a magazine.
Right.
That degree of separation is non-existent. Like, your life, that doesn't mean suddenly that you don't have the same feelings you would have if you lived next door to them.
Yeah, and you're not sheltered from this information. It's out there in the universe, and people pass it along to you, and you end end up these things, and everybody can't believe it. You know?
Yeah, yeah. I just and that's so. I think that's what I hope happens is that realizing that everybody's just connected in that way, and that it's so immediate, and that it's so easy to find out and hear everything that gets said. The dream, the fantasy would be that people would start to be more responsible about that, because at a certain point they realize, like, oh, Neil just tickled his baby's belly. And probably I shouldn't say something horrible about him
because
he's a guy that's
and
nice.
It's wonderful, and that's the kind of stuff that's exciting to read. But I think there's this anonymity behind it.
Yeah.
So you can say whatever you want with a mask on, and no one's gonna go, hey, that was really shitty for you to say that.
Yeah. It's bullying.
Yeah.
It's like, guess what? You're a bully.
And you can really do it, you know, without anyone ever knowing. And so that's the flip side to it.
Yeah.
You know, that's the bad side to it. And like I said, I think originally these were really great ideas and can be great ideas and should be great ideas.
Yeah.
I just, everyone has to be nice to each other.
I know.
You know, everywhere. It seems so be simple. Nice to your neighbors, you know, be nice.
It seems just, so simple.
We all have feelings. And I think, you know, that's the thing too is, you know, for people in high school and all of that too is I can't even imagine how that must translate into the school system.
I know.
That must feel like when such close quarters with one another. I know. Be nice to each other.
I know. Let me ask you this, thinking about feelings and thinking about being hurt. I wanted to just go back, and I don't mean to pry about your relationship, but I am interested that you just dated one boy when you were in high school in Virginia. And was he in theater, did you say?
He was not, no.
That's unusual, huh? To have like a really long-term relationship in high school, or is it?
I mean, there were other boys that I thought were cute and like, you know, stuff.
But you guys obviously had like a great friendship as well, and like a really
he is a great person.
Yeah. Did you feel like because you sort of had that fairly, you know, if you had a kind of a monogamous teenager relationship, did you feel like the pressure that other people might have felt about sex and all that kind of stuff? Or did you feel like you saw it happening more to your friends, but you kind of had a stability in a relationship with someone that meant something?
Yeah, I mean, because I came from Idaho, I wasn't involved in that.
Yeah.
Honestly.
I'm not saying I was.
Yeah, but, I remember moving to Virginia and being like, whoa, people are much more sophisticated here than I'm.
I was weirded out by it.
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely was like, I remember the first time I French kissed someone, I was like, I was like, this is super gross. Like I wasn't into him really. And it just, I don't think he was very good at it. But the first few times
I
was like,
I'm sure he wasn't.
I mean, he doesn't know. No, the guy I was my first French kiss does not know they were my first French kiss. But like, I definitely was like, I'm doing something faster than my feelings need me to be doing it. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, am I faster than my hormones need me to be doing it? I'm in a situation where clearly if I were ready for this, perhaps I would enjoy it. But right now it just feels like, why is there someone else's tongue in my mouth?
Ew, gross.
And, there's something to be said for that. Like, if that's true, you know, I don't know if I can say specifically that like I had sex before I should have or anything like that. But I do remember certain benchmarks where I can say, like, you know, I didn't enjoy it. And I wish that the first time could have been something that, you know, even if it's just as simple as that, or like when, you know, the first time I got drunk or something, like, probably shouldn't have. Like, I was too young.
I think I was so sort of startled by the sophistication level of all these girls in Virginia that I found this defiant behavior, and I was like, I found a coolness in still being from Idaho.
I get
it. So I just kind of stuck with that and spoke about it, you know, and said, you know, we don't do that in Idaho.
Yeah. Good for you.
All my friends were kind of like, that's cool.
Yeah. You know? Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Well, that's what Carrie was talking about. She was with like a super hardcore straight edge guy, and I had kind of forgotten about straight edge.
Oh yeah.
But like there's that piece of punk, like I think I dated one guy who was straight edge, but that's such a specific thing too. The idea of like anarchy, like, you know, I've got a mohawk and I'm wearing black eyeliner, but I've never smoked a cigarette. I've never taken a sip of alcohol. Yes. I've never had sex. I've never like people who didn't like have caffeine or sugar.
That was big in DC.
It's so interesting.
But they all had shaved heads.
Yeah. And then when does that become like, just a straight head, like a skinhead, like a straight head skinhead. Uh-oh.
They all had shaved heads and knee-high oxblood Doc Martens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they all look like skinheads.
I couldn't afford real Doc Martens. I had fake ones.
I still have my first pair I had to save up so much money for it. And I had like, I didn't have the last $3 or something. And I stood out on the street in Georgetown and panhandled the last $3 to
get my first pair. That's how it should be. If you got to get your Docs that way, that's
pretty
gorgeous.
So I still have them in my closet because, one, they're comfortable and they still fit. But, you know, it was a big deal to save up for that.
Yeah,
they were expensive. My first job, the very first thing I did with my first paycheck is I went and bought a leather jacket, leather motorcycle jacket at Wilson's Leather in the mall.
Yes.
And I had it until a month ago.
You really had to save up for that. Oh, I don't keep stuff. I'm bad with that.
I don't keep a lot of things, those were quite sentimental to
me,
because my parents were like, you will not wear that motorcycle jacket. You will not. And I was like, yes, I will. It's my money and I've got a job. So I really fought for that motorcycle jacket.
I'm so glad you kept that. And I love that you kept your Docs too. That's fantastic.
Yeah. I was just sifting through my closet the other day and I picked them up periodically and I'm like, should I get rid of them? And I'm like, nah, they don't take up much space.
I gotta hang on to them. Yeah, that's good. That's good. And then where did you go to college?
I didn't go to college.
That's right. New York.
I went straight to New York and started modeling at the time.
Yeah. I feel like I used college as a thing to just like protect me from doing what I really wanted to be doing. I don't know that I used it as like, this is about my education. I was like, oh, I'm not ready to do anything but go to college.
I sometimes am embarrassed that I didn't go.
I don't think there's any reason for that.
Regret that. But at the time, I was having such a hard time in high school and was just really unhappy. And
in terms of academically or just in terms of
actually, I was a really good student.
Yeah.
But just socially, I was just very depressed and didn't like the way people acted in school and just felt really sad. And it kind of spoiled it for me. I just wanted to get out of a sort of place where I felt ridiculed.
Yeah.
And to me, school represented that at the time. And I had auditioned
I'm surprised because I'm only surprised because I've now have this image of you being this stalwart, like, listen, I'm from Idaho and like you were a goth and you were cool and you had a cool boyfriend and you had good friends. So I guess in my mind, I was like, oh, she had a great high school experience, but you felt depressed.
I stood firm in all those things, but it was hard.
Yeah.
You know, it was hard, and I'm a very emotional person. So even if something wasn't happening directly to me, there were a lot of fights in my school, kids getting beat up. There was a lot of race tension in my school.
I was going to ask about that because you were in Virginia. Tucson's like that too. There's like a lot of.
And so it was, even if it wasn't happening directly to me, it was happening all around me, and it was very upsetting.
Yeah,
it was an upsetting environment.
Yeah,
And
it's weird when you feel trapped in that environment, like that helplessness of being that age. And I remember thinking so many times, like the difference between somebody who does drop out of high school or somebody who really, like I still, whatever, and I joke about with Paul sometimes, like that I was a people pleaser is probably what kept me from rebelling more and giving more into my depression. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, as much as I tried to skip class or as much as I tried to fake sick so I didn't have to go to school and as miserable as I was about certain things, I was also so terrified of doing a bad job that I was like still a good student, which was even worse because then I was like, I'm miserable. And I would get up and then I would wake up with just crippling depression in the morning. Like I don't know how I'm going to go.
Yeah.
And so many times my poor sweet dad, I'm sorry, dad, if you're listening to this, you probably knew when I was faking, but I would be like, cause my dad was a single father raising me. I would be like, I have such bad cramps, dad.
Oh yeah.
And he trusted that. Yeah. I mean, and so I would get out of like the first two periods of school. And it really wasn't that I was like out to just sleep in. I was like, whatever, dad. I literally was depressed. Yeah. I mean, I literally was like, I'm crying thinking about getting out of bed right now, and I just need someone to tell me I don't have to go right now. And I still have dreams about not wanting to go to high school. I have dreams like of waking up in the morning at home and being like, oh God, I don't want to go. Don't make me go.
And now you don't have to.
And now I don't have to. So, you know, going to college for me was like, honestly, for me, it was a way of moving out of Tucson because I knew I right. wanted to have a different experience. But it sounds like you went ahead and went to New York and kind of took that plunge.
Well, I had these two options. You know, I had pre-auditioned for the theater department at Virginia Commonwealth University, and I had already been accepted to the school with my test scores and, mm-hmm. and my grades and everything. So I had a slot open, and it was ready to go. But I had a lot of friends who had already started to go to the school, and they were in the theater department, and I thought, I just don't feel like this is getting me where I want to be eventually.
Yeah.
And I had this opportunity to move to New York and start modeling. And although modeling wasn't my idea of what career I was starting, it gave me an opportunity to move to New York City mm-hmm. to start to travel internationally, which I'd never done. It
yeah.
was so exciting and an education in itself. And I just thought, gosh, I just feel like if I move to New York,
yeah,
there's going to be more opportunity there than in Richmond, Virginia.
Sure.
And I could have been wrong. I could have ended up in the same place in the end. It would have been a different route.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the one I took, and it was great for me. And like I said, it allowed me to travel, which mm-hmm. was really exciting.
Did you ever feel scared about, I mean, in terms of moving to New York, knowing that when you look and kind of see, oh, here's this room for opportunity, that's exciting. But for someone like me, when I was your age, I tell you right now, I would be too afraid.
I mean, terrified.
I'm so impressed that you worked through that, and I'm interested in what you told yourself or how you kind of worked through that or whether you had a support system of friends or parents. I just, because I feel like my dad thought I could do anything, so it's not like it's his fault. I mean, I had his support. He thought I should move to LA. You know, he wanted me to go to a Carnegie Mellon he wanted me to do whatever I wanted, but he was fully prepared to imagine me getting, like, trying to be in show business from a really young age, even if that meant no college. And I was felt really supported in that way. But I just didn't believe in, I guess I just didn't believe whether in myself or I was just too afraid of, even if I thought I was good enough, I was afraid everybody else would make me feel bad about myself because yeah. I knew what it felt like to feel bad about myself or to feel judged. And I was like, I don't want any more of that.
I think it was a couple things. I think one, I was going into unknown territory. I didn't know what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know what to be scared of.
Yeah.
But when I got to New York, I was terrified. I remember standing in Grand Central Station with my mom trying to figure out, you know, at the time it was still the tokens used for the subway, and just people whizzing by me at such
yeah.
a pace that I yeah. just, I remember being like, oh gosh, I'm in the way. How do I get out of the way? And how do I get onto that train? I
yeah.
don't know. And I was scared, and I went home to Virginia, and I said, I don't think I can do this.
Yeah.
And it was another 3 months, and I thought, but I can't do this either. I can't. Yeah. I think it was – the choice was what's scarier, New York and the unknown or Virginia and this is it. This is
yeah.
– you know, I know yeah. what's here. So that became scarier to me.
Yeah.
So I decided to go ahead and go, and I would come home almost every weekend. I'd take the bus home and – you know, I just need to sort of drive out into the country and just get a little country vibe. And then I
sure.
get on the bus and go back to New York. And I would stop on the street sometimes. You know, I always had my little headphones in so I couldn't hear what people were screaming at me on the street. And I would stop and look around me every once in a while and just reach up and pat myself on the back and be like, you're okay.
That's
you're okay.
So good,
you're doing
though.
It. You
that's
know,
so
okay.
important. I think that's something that I wish someone had. I mean, I people other than my mom or you know, I would have loved to have had that resource. I feel like I got so much out of like Sassy magazine when I was a teenager
because it
just made me feel so like I like the self empowerment was so important, and I felt like. I think I relied so heavily on other people to tell me I was good or I was okay mm. or whatever. And which is weird because when you're an only child, you would think that you would build up more like only child from divorced parents. Like I would build up a little bit stronger metal, but, I don't think I would have been able to, like, I would have not been able to give myself that pat on the back. Mm. And I think that's so, I mean, gosh, what a great gift to have and what a great thing to be able to do, and what I would wish for every young woman is to be able to say, yeah, I'm making a scary choice, but to be on your own side. It sounds like you were on your own side. You know what I mean? And I think I came up against myself. Mm-hmm. Like, I think I was ready to say, you're not doing this. You're not doing this right. Or like, everybody's going to hate you, instead of right. the pat on the back.
I had to remind myself to do it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there were many times where I would just come home at the end of a long day, traipsing around New York City, trying to get a job, and, you know, just sit on my futon and cry.
Yeah.
You know, and be scared and overwhelmed but so it, you know, it was an effort to stop and look around and pat yourself on the back for certain.
Yeah. Were you like dating people and having to deal with all that scariness too at the time? Like, oh, now I'm wondering if someone's going to call me, and wondering if someone's going to call me with a job. And
I was living with my boyfriend. So
nice.
I wasn't dating in New York, and he was incredibly supportive. And
because that's a lot. It's a lot to imagine being really young. And,
oh, I can't imagine. Right? I was already dealing with being 18, 19 in New York. You need
that having some stability and having that support. That's cool. That's really cool.
Yeah. There was not a lot of running around New York when I first got there. I mean, I was running around all day, so I was learning the city and on subways and all these things in my, you know, silly little high heels as a model running around, you know, uncomfortably. And so at night it was a lot of like renting movies from Blockbuster and eating sorbet.
Oh, yeah.
And just chilling.
Yeah.
Because it was so overwhelming during the day.
I feel like that. I mean, it took me a while even just being here to not feel like, I mean, it's such a slower pace here, but just the sense of like putting on a personality all day.
Right.
It becomes so nice to just come home and watch movies and let somebody else do all the work for you. And I think that's what people, I mean, not just in our business, but like, what gets hard about that is that people can socialize less if they work all day and they're exhausted and they're using their brains. Or sometimes you're even more tired if you're not, if you have a job that you don't love, if you're a receptionist, or, you know, not that you can't love being a receptionist, but if you feel like you don't get to think enough or what have you in whatever career, that's sometimes more exhausting than anything. But then you come home and it's hard to kind of check in with yourself and feel alive and vibrant. And I don't know, it's interesting to feel like I navigate like where I'm getting that and where I'm putting that energy out and where it makes most sense to. And sometimes I give it all to one thing that didn't deserve it. And then like the place that it should be with me in my home and my relationship, if I've got nothing left, I always have to get better, you know? It's like a constant thing to check in with.
Yeah. And I think also, in our business, you know, so much of our work is about promoting a project that we've been on or going to something. So we have to go out in the evening, and then it sort of becomes a 24/7 job in Los Angeles when so many people are in the same business. And if you just go to a dinner party, the next thing you know, it's like,
you can't, there's no separation. There's no separation.
Yeah. Cause there's a director there that you worked with or a producer that, you know, or whatever it is. And so sometimes just staying home is the nicest thing in the world.
Yeah.
To give yourself a break from all that and, you know, be a family and cook and do all
it
that
sounds
nice
well
stuff.
It sounds like it just based on, you know, kind of the experience you had in Idaho and the way you connect it to being home and that being really important and the way that you kind of check in with yourself through your relationships in your home environment, that's kind of what keeps coming up for me as we're talking, that I kind of feel like this for me, that's what this episode would be about a little bit, is like that you're not going to, like, you have to have that place to come back to, or you're not going to have the strength and the energy to take risks or to believe in yourself or to go out there and face your own fear. And it sounds to me like you just seem so grounded in terms of, like, you know, you had, this is the stability that you had, and then you found a way to represent that in your life as all of these crazy things that have been amazing and scary and hard and fun.
My husband and my family, and I also have a tremendous group of friends in Los Angeles, and, you know, they won't let me get away with anything too. You know, I check in with them because they're my best friends. They love me for who I am. They nurture me. And, you know, sometimes when the public or whoever it is, all these different people trying to say who you are or what you're supposed to be or redefine who you are, those are the people who know who you really are.
Yeah.
And so if at any moment you're like, wait, I can't do that because I'm not supposed to because someone said I wasn't supposed to. They're like, give me a break.
You're you. Dude.
That's what you do, you know?
Yeah.
So it, for me, it's incredibly important. And my husband is amazing at that too. And him also being an actor and being in this business, you know, we have to do it for each other.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
be like, wait, don't get crazy.
Yeah.
You're a wonderful person. Don't let someone make you feel crazy. You
know? And it feels so good to be able to be that support for someone else. You know,
it does.
To feel, it just feels great. If you don't have kids, if you don't want to have kids, if you do want, you don't have them yet, any of that, as women our age, like, it's just nice to feel. I love caretaking in that way because it's not about me for a change. I mean, it's still selfish because it makes me feel good, but it's nice to be like, oh, I really made someone else feel less crazy.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's great. That made me feel so good, you know?
I completely agree. I don't have children of my own, but I definitely consider myself a nurturer, and I think it's because my mother is such a wonderful and tender woman, and so my husband and my friends, we all do that for one another and take care of each other when we need it and take turns, you know.
Jump company.
Oh, it's all, it all goes
it's
back
a
to
jump
company.
Company full of friends is what you've got here. Is that what are we about? Where are we? Perfect. Perfect. All right. We're going to wrap it up with that and say, everybody, you just need to find your own jump company.
That's right.
And it doesn't have to be that group, but find your support system and make sure to be supportive of yourself because it's not always just about everybody else and what they think. And Christina, thank you so much for
doing
this.
Thanks for having
me. This
was awesome.
You were fantastic.
Thank you.
All right. See you next time. I always say see you next time. I'm not ever going to see you. It's a podcast. Goodbye. As always, the JV Club theme song is Before We Were Brittle, courtesy of the amazing Say Hi.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.